This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a mistake to think the Dow Jones Industrial Average represents the whole U.S. economy. It is only 30 companies, after all. But the Dow can tell you things about that economy, especially when it moves the way it's been moving lately. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you with us on this Monday, everybody. It is the 9th of November today, and you have to go back more than a year to find a higher close for the Dow Industrials. The blue chips topped 10,200 today. But what matters in the market sometimes aren't the highs and the lows. It's the what happens in betweens, how much the market moves in the course of a day or of a week. Chris Lowe is the chief economist at FTN Financial in New York. Chris, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
I wanted to talk to you about the market, not so much the absolute level, but some of these ups and downs we've been seeing. The volatility, it seems to me, has been increasing of late, no?
Oh, absolutely. We've been up a ton the last 2 days. And of course, the prior 2 weeks, the market was selling off. And volatility often is the hallmark of a turning point.
When you say turning point here, I'm guessing you're referring to the possibility of turning down, yeah?
That's the tough part. It could be turning down. It could also be turning up after a correction of a month and a half. And I think you're probably better off focused on fundamentals. And if you're looking at the fundamentals and you see this kind of volatility in the market, it's probably an indication that the market is ready to move to a higher level rather than a lower one.
Really?
Let me connect some dots
for
you. Yeah, please. Some of the big reports we've had in just the last 2 weeks, starting with GDP in the third quarter. Right, 3.5%. Then we had a productivity report, 9.5% productivity growth in the third quarter. And then, of course, the employment report last Friday, more jobs lost. You know, these three fit together. Basically, what's happening is that companies are cutting costs in part by cutting workers, and all that saving is going straight to the bottom line in the form of earnings. So for people who work for a living, it's terrible, but for stockholders, it's good news. And I think that's why the market is up.
But, you know, to a layman's appreciation, you look at that unemployment number and the analysis we have that it's only going to get worse from here. And how do you rationalize that against a rising market?
This is the part where the economist takes a step back and the human being comes in. You know, I see this trend and it's terrifying. I've got kids in college who are probably going to want a job someday. The good thing is it's not permanent. You can't grow productivity at a rate like that for more than a quarter or two. At some point, you're trying to squeeze savings where they just don't exist anymore. And I have spoken to CEOs who tell me they're reluctant to do it, but looks like they're going to have to start hiring because otherwise they're going to lose market share. And that reluctance is exactly what you see in the beginning of every employment recovery. And then soon enough, they begin to realize, you know, this isn't such a bad thing. I'm growing the business. The earnings are still coming in. And you get a self-sustaining true recovery.
What about the theory, Chris, that we're just setting ourselves up for another bubble? You've got really cheap money. Interest rates are low. What's your take on that?
That's the danger of using stimulus. And this is the third recession in a row that ended because the government spent our way out. The last two, it was monetary policy, the Fed setting up an easy money situation. This time, it's all that plus the stimulus bill. The risk is that they don't know when to turn it off. We obviously hope that they'll get it right this time. The Fed has assured us they'll get it right this time. And if they get it wrong, we will have another bubble.
Christopher Lowe, he's the chief economist at FTN Financial in New York City. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Fears of a bubble or not, 203 points was the gain on the Dow Industrials today. That was matched percentage-wise on the other major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big media merger of the moment is a possible deal between General Electric and Comcast, the cable company. The GE would sell off a controlling stake, 51%, in NBC Universal. Rumors about it have been floating around for weeks, and so far, that's all it still is, rumors. But the whole process did move one giant step closer to becoming real over the weekend. Both sides are said to have agreed that NBC is worth about $30 billion or so. That gives us some idea of what a sale of the Peacock network might eventually be worth. But Comcast isn't doing this deal just to own the home of 30 Rock and Law & Order. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
What Comcast wants is NBC's cable properties, everything from sci-fi to the Weather Channel. Stacey Kramer is co-editor at Content Next Media. She says cable channels are highly profitable.
Cable is this sort of holy grail revenue that people are looking for right now, that media companies want, because it's based on licensing fees, but it also has advertising income.
It's a letdown for NBC Television, which used to be the media jewel in GE's crown. Hal Vogel is a media analyst. He says NBC's TV network is struggling these days.
Because local advertisers, the car dealers and the department stores and so on, are not advertising on the local stations the way they had been before. The network itself is mired in fourth place.
But Comcast is focused elsewhere. Stacey Kramer says it wants to build out its sports programming. NBC's Universal Sports would be part of that. And then there are popular entertainment channels like Bravo and USA Network.
USA Network is an incredibly successful network and has been much more successful at incubating new shows to some extent than its parent company.
As for the encroaching internet, cable TV has managed to hold its ground so far. Hal Vogel says viewers are still watching and cable operators are still subscribing to the network's content. But he says 5 to 10 years from now, things could look rather different.
There's a real question mark whether there will be any sizable growth or any growth at all of cable subscribers. And the only way to hold on to the subscription fees is to have the content that people want.
He says those NBC cable shows would be just that, high-quality content viewers are prepared to pay for, at least for now. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming tomorrow to a financial crisis near you, the latest congressional offering for how to regulate the country's banking system. Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, is set to release his plan for how to do that. There is already a set of reform proposals moving through the House. Dodd's version would differ from it in a couple of ways. He wants to consolidate all federal bank regulators into one agency, and he would strip the Federal Reserve of its powers as a bank supervisor. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Alice Rivlin served as the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve during the Clinton administration. But if you ask her about the Fed's record, she doesn't mince words.
The Fed has not had a very strong record as a regulator.
Congress gave the Fed the authority to regulate mortgages, and many say that for 14 years, the Fed did nothing. And that's not all.
The experience with bank holding companies, which the Fed did regulate, is not so encouraging that you'd want to give them more responsibility.
Citigroup's near collapse? Maybe the Fed should have caught that. Eugene Ludwig was a top bank regulator in the 90s. He says federal financial regulation right now is so fragmented that investigators who find problems can't always chase them down.
You want
the cop on the beat to be able to go over the county line, if you will, to inspect where the problem is.
But with one regulator covering a bank and another watching the parent company, that cop is often left at the county line with sirens flashing. And banks are also free to shop around and pick federal regulators they like. So Ludwig and Rivlin would like to see one regulator with sweeping jurisdiction. Senator Dodd's bill may do that. But Ludwig says the administration's current proposal and the bill in the House don't go nearly far enough.
To solve a near catastrophe for our financial system by doing the same old, it seems to me, is very dangerous indeed.
But Dodd's bill is likely to face stiff opposition in the Senate. Bankers, it turns out, are pretty comfortable with the status quo. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Not to be forgotten in economic news today is health care. The House of Representatives passed its version of an overhaul package late Saturday night, which means it's just about time for the real negotiating to get going. Any group that didn't get what it wanted, and there are plenty, can now make its case with the Senate as it gets ready to take up the subject. One group that is grumbling louder than most is employers, as Joel Rose reports.
Small business advocates complain that the House bill would impose new insurance obligations on employers while doing little to contain costs.
This bill does nothing at all to address the high cost of health insurance.
That's Michelle Dimarob at the National Federation of Independent Business. She says small businesses are especially unhappy about the so-called employer mandate, a provision that would force them to offer insurance coverage or face a financial penalty.
These employer mandates and these atrocious new taxes are going to force small business owners to eliminate jobs and freeze expansion plans at the very time when we need our small businesses to help move us out of this recession.
The employer mandate wouldn't take full effect for 5 years, and it would only apply to businesses with at least $500,000 in payroll. Supporters of the House bill point out that it does include some insurance market reforms, like prohibiting insurers from discriminating against people who are already sick. John Arensmeyer at the Small Business Majority says the House bill is better than nothing.
The healthcare status quo is totally unacceptable, and this House bill is light years better than the status quo.
Still, many business lobbyists prefer the overhaul approved by the Senate Finance Committee. That bill does not require employers to insure their workers. And according to John Castellani at the Business Roundtable, it would do more to contain costs.
If the end result is the costs go up, then we have not accomplished anything from a healthcare delivery standpoint, and certainly not from the standpoint of companies who have to compete in global marketplaces.
Castellani will be making his case to members of the Senate over the next few weeks, along with just about every other lobbyist in town. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
About the only thing that didn't do well in the markets today was the dollar. Stocks rose, oil and gold were up. The greenback, however, continued its recent slide, and the general perception is that that's a bad thing. Commentator Paul Kudrowski says it might be time to readjust those perceptions.
The U.S. dollar isn't doing all that bad. It has actually climbed in the last year against a bunch of currencies. Well, some. All right, maybe eight. The Argentinian peso, the Algerian dinar, the Fiji dollar, the Ghana cedi, which were clobbering mercilessly, the Jamaican dollar, the Pakistani rupee, the Sri Lankan rupee, and of course, the Vietnamese dong. We're not keeping great currency company. That's why plenty of people are unhappy about the dollar's decline. Some worry that it will mean inflation and a diminished U.S. standard of living. Others see it as a loss of status. As the dollar sinks, there's fear that cabals of U.S.-hating merchants will move to price major commodities, like oil, in other currencies, making the dollar sink further. The worry is wasted. Yes, a lower dollar is going to cause some prices to go up, and an uncontrolled decline in the dollar would be calamitous for funding the giant U.S. deficit. But both remain unlikely. For all its fiscal flaws, this country is in better financial shape than many of its largest trading partners, like Japan. A lower dollar, to a point, is actually good for U.S. trade. It makes U.S. exports cheaper and more competitive, which increases sales. That's important if we want to cut down our trade deficit and try to get this economy healthy again. Sure, given China's loose currency peg, a lower dollar won't slash our huge trade deficit with that country. But the weak dollar is already helping raise exports to every other top trading partner, from Canada on down. This country might like a higher dollar. It feels so good. But it needs a lower one right now. More exports will take pressure off U.S. consumers. It's time someone else drove this economy for a while.
Paul Kodrowski is an economist in San Diego. His blog is called Infectious Greed. There's a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, there's a link that says contact, too. Coming up, Germans who miss the old days.
All people in the GDR had to work. All people. And now a lot of people have no work. We have fear for the future. Have I next year this job?
But first, let's do the numbers. News that the G20 is going to keep the stimulus cash flowing swept stocks higher today. The Dow Industrials bounded up 2%, 203 points, closed at 10,226. The NASDAQ rose 1.9%, 41 points, ended at 2154. The S&P 500 jumped more than 2%, 23 points, closed at 1,093. Commodities prices powered higher, led, as I mentioned, by gold and oil, which spouted above $80 a barrel at one point today. Oil exploration company Schlumberger flowed up more than 1%. Mining company Freeport-McMoRan dug up 4.5%. Barrick Gold jumped 3.33%. Caterpillar tracked up more than 4% today. American Express led financial shares higher. That as banks celebrated the stimulus news. The credit card company's shares slid up nearly 5%. Both MasterCard and Visa followed suit, rising roughly 2% apiece. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at sunguard.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Former President Bill Clinton speaks at the annual World Healthcare Innovation and Technology Congress. The three-day conference is about improving health and healthcare through IT. A Senate subcommittee on children and families talks about paid sick days and the H1N1 flu. And on November 10, 1983, Microsoft unveiled Windows. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Tomorrow and Wednesday in New York, it is art auction time. It's the fall contemporary season at Sotheby's and Christie's. Paintings by Andy Warhol, Jasper Johns, Willem de Kooning, and many others are going to be up for sale. And just a couple of years ago, a lot of those paintings would have been flying off the auction block, hammered down for tens of millions of dollars. To find out how things might shape up this fall, we've called art dealer Richard Polsky. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Give me the art market vibe right now, would you?
Well, I'm happy to say it's rapidly improving. We had two very good sales at Sotheby's and Christie's. These were the Impressionist and Modern sales. Actually, Christie's was okay. I shouldn't over-exaggerate it. But Sotheby's ended up exceeding the total that they expected to bring in. And that set the vibe, I'd say, in the bar pretty high for this week's sales, for the contemporary sales.
Everybody in this art market knows that there's this huge recession, right? And unemployment's at 10.2% in the whole deal?
But the people who buy art, they're not the 10.2%. 3-4 years ago, it was like everyone into the pool. You had all these people who loved art, but you also had a lot of speculators. People saying, hey, art's got the hot hand. It's a tangible asset. I'm going to move some money into it. and they were grossly overpaying. You also had these Russian oligarchs just overbidding on blue chip paintings. The market was really international back then. It's kind of slimmed down now. Anyone buying now, long-term player, connoisseur, wants to live with the art, not buying to flip.
Now, you have a client with a painting that's coming up for auction, right?
Right, right. Basically, years ago in the art market, the way I'd make my living is you would come to me. You have an Andy Warhol painting for sale, let's say. And I'd say, great, I'm going to handle the sale. I'm going to get you the best deal, and I'm going to, of course, make a profit. Usually, I'd be looking to make 10% on a deal like that. But with the rise of the auction houses and their dominance, all of a sudden, you come to me with that same Warhol, and it would be disingenuous of me to say, give it to me, when clearly the better deal is to test the auction waters. So now what I've done is basically said, okay, you're going to auction with that painting. However, let me represent you. Let me go to Sotheby's and Christie's and get you the best deal.
Sort of sounds like you've created a middleman job here.
Well, that's what it is. You know, I hate to say I'm an art advisor or financial advisor, but it really does come down to pure business at this point. You have to know what you're holding as an art dealer. You come to me with a painting, I've got to make a determination. Do I have an ace here or just a seven? But if I've got the ace, you know, you drive a hard deal.
So what kinds of paintings are selling?
I'm going to give you an example of something that will probably do well at this current round of sales. Back in 1967, there were two women who wanted to work for Andy Warhol. They go to his gallery. It's called Leo Castelli. And they meet his gallery director, a guy named Ivan Karp. And they say, hey, we want to work for Andy. And he says, just a minute. He gets Warhol on the phone. I mean, you could do that in those days.
Yeah, right.
It's a different world. And he says, hey, I've got two squirrels here who want to come work for you. Anyway, they go to work for him. One of them sticks it out. The other, I think, quit. After working for him for a year and she was not getting paid, he was working on these self-portraits. And Warhol says to her, here, why don't you pick one out? Okay, these paintings are 22 inches square. And she picks out, I don't know, the woman had a sixth sense. One of the best ones I've ever seen. Purple, red, and green. Killer pop colors. Just beautiful. Anyway, flash forward. She's hung on to that painting until now. Decides to finally bring it out, and it's coming up at Sotheby's. Estimate, $1 million to $1.5 million.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Instant millionaire.
Richard Polsky. He's an art dealer, art advisor, I guess you are, right, Richard? He's also the author of the recent book, I Sold Andy Warhol Too Soon. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
In Germany today, Chancellor Angela Merkel led the celebrations marking 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. She reenacted her own crossing of what was then the border between East and West on the night of November 9th, 1989. Democracy and capitalism brought a lot of changes to East Germany. Most would probably say for the better, but reunification has not always been easy, even in one of the East's most successful cities. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now from Leipzig, Germany.
Leipzig today is very different from the city of 20 years ago. Back then, it was an industrial center polluted by coal mining and chemical plants.
Decayed, soot-covered, evil-smelling.
Heinrich Lehmann Gruber came here from Hanover to serve as Leipzig's first post-reunification mayor. He found a city where roads and buildings were crumbling from decades of neglect. But before World War II, Leipzig had been one of Germany's wealthiest cities and an arts and culture powerhouse.
If you look closely, you could still see that, like somebody who looks at an old garden where many winters have gone over, but you can see how it was meant to be, and this attracted me.
It attracted others, too. In 1991, Chris Smith arrived from Frankfurt to set up a new branch of consulting firm Price Waterhouse.
It was a very get-up-and-go time. You know, I'd say to people, well, you know, if you want to play tennis, then, well, build a tennis court, yeah? If you want it to get done, don't look to anybody else to do it. You're here to do it yourself.
That spirit and money from the West helped rebuild Leipzig. Today, Smith heads an office of more than 100 employees in this thriving modern city with its lively art scene and growing population. But reunification also opened the region to competition from companies in Western Germany. 100,000 mining and other jobs disappeared, And unemployment in Leipzig is twice as high as in many Western cities. One economic bright spot is this ultra-modern BMW plant.
So we're in a body shop now, and we just have a look at more than 700 robots doing most of the work here.
BMW spokesman Michael Jansen leads me through the welding area, where sparks fly as the frame of a 1-series hatchback takes shape. He says the plant has created some 5,000 jobs.
When we came here, the unemployment rate was more than 21%, which was quite bad for the region, but it was good for us because we could choose really skilled people and they were available.
They were cheaper, too. Jansen says workers here make about 25% less than their counterparts in BMW's home base of Bavaria. Johann Stadt of Berlin's Free University says lower wages in eastern Germany are supposed to keep the region competitive. He says that seemed fair when the cost of living was also much lower.
But nowadays, when you go shopping, you pay the same prices. The people say, well, when we pay the same prices, why don't we not earn for the same work the same amount of money?
Stadt says this is one reason many in eastern Germany say they were better off in the old days. That nostalgia shows up here in support for the left, the successor to the Communist Party. At the main train station in Leipzig, Katrin Dost serves bratwurst to travelers at a small sausage stand. She has a job, but she understands why some long for the days of the communist German Democratic Republic.
Because all people in the GDR had to work. All people. And now a lot of people have no work. We have fear for the future. Have I next year this job?
Officials in Leipzig are working to attract new industries like green technology. And one economist told me in some ways the region's weakness has actually helped it ride out the global recession. Companies aren't as dependent on exports as those in Western Germany, where unemployment has actually risen faster. In Leipzig, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can see for yourself how different Leipzig was 20 years ago. There is a video on our website as well as a slideshow of the places that Amy visited for that story. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today getting us back to where we started, the stock market. Our friends at ClusterStock.com posted an intriguing item this morning that Rupert Murdoch is thinking about selling off his stock indexing division. In his capacity as the head of News Corp, Murdoch is also the owner of the Dow Jones Company. And entirely apart from publishing the Wall Street Journal, it also runs a substantial side business publishing stock indexes, like, just for instance, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Soon, possibly the bought by the highest bidder industrial average? Who knows? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, at least as far as it's still known, bounded up 2%, 203 points, closed to 10,226. The NASDAQ gained 1.9%, 41 points, ended at 2154. The S&P 500 jumped more than 2%, 22 points, closed at 1,091. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, one CEO's perspective on the climate change bill.
Cap and trade is essential because all the other ways we have of trying to deal with the climate problem are much more expensive for the consumer.
It's another conversation from the corner office. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.